Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurink, Jacob Kanzler, and our special guest this week, Tom Shields from Marketing Resource Group. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
It's Iowa caucus day, and it's not snowing here, but it could be snowing in Iowa a little later. We'll touch on the storm that's going on in the Hawkeye State in just a second. But first of all, Tom, obviously you've been looking at all the coverage that the governor has been getting since this Flint water crisis took off. Is there anything that he can be doing to try and reverse the public opinion, kind of change the way these news stories are going? Because he's just getting pummeled week in and week out.
You know, the governor's been playing catch-up from day one. I mean, they can go back to October. I mean, he's been playing catch-up on this issue, and it's gotten ahead of him, and it keeps getting ahead of him. He needs somehow to figure out how to get ahead of it. I mean, if I were him, I would promise the people of Flint, I'm going to change the pipes. I mean, that's the way you stop the debate. You commit that we are going to take the lead pipes out, and we're going to replace them. Know how we're going to do it? Then go out and find the funding. I mean, that's the way you get ahead of this thing. Otherwise, you just... You know, this is a Band-Aid approach. I mean, you have to do this. You got to provide people with water. You have to do other things. But I mean, it seems like every week there's something coming out that puts him back on defensive again. The water cooler story and those kind of things just keep pushing him further and further behind, even though he's like on a treadmill here and he's going backwards. And he needs to get out in front of it. I think, you know, maybe that's the way to do it. If it costs, you know, $40 million to take, you know, these lead pipes out, you know, fine $40 million bucks. You already put $28 million into just as a stopgap measure. You know, feds need to step up. At some point in time, the feds aren't stepping up at all. I mean, $80 million low-interest loan is nothing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do anything for the city of Flint. I mean, they need to step up. I mean, EPA was a part of this just as much as anybody else. But again, that's the way you take hold of the issue, put pressure on everybody else, put pressure on the legislature, and go out and find a way to get rid of those lead pipes. Because that's the only way these people, I think, are going to go back and drink their water and feel safe about that.
One of the things that we always talk about as part of the process is the message, obviously, right? One of the messages the governor's team has really been putting out is it was a failure at all levels of government. Give me your sense of, from a PR perspective, a professional PR person, is that a good message? What's your read on that?
You know, sharing the blame, I guess, is a little bit, but I think he needs to go beyond that. I mean, it's like, you know, he got hit with the water cooler story, and his response was, well, the water coolers were open to the general public. I mean, that's just ridiculous. I don't understand, you know, that's that strategy at all. I mean, he needs to, again, get control of this issue, be the person out there who's leading the bandwagon, leading the call for volunteers, leading the call for people to donate water. You know, instead of having people sort of doing it on their own, you ought to be orchestrated by the state as much as we possibly can. And then do something to change the pipes, because you're never going to get over this issue, and do it before you're forced into it. You may get at some point in time forced into changing those pipes. And then you're going to look, you know, even worse. You know, you're being dragged into changing these pipes to do the right thing.
On that note, the debate seems to be playing out now is kind of how quickly do you change the pipes? I think the governor and others are trying to take a methodical approach to doing an infrastructure study to seeing how big the cost is. Is that not quick enough, you think, to address what you're kind of getting at?
It's government. You know, it's government that people don't trust. You got to say, this is what we're going to do, then you go figure it out and do it. And, you know, take a page out of Trump's book. I mean, Trump basically says we're going to be great again. Didn't tell you how. He just tells you we're going to be great again, you know. And he provides, you know, that promise to people. And I think what he needs to do is say, listen, we're going to change these pipes. We're going to do it right. That's the only way the people of Flint are going to believe he's done the right thing here. And I think the only thing that takes away some of the national pressure that's going on is just to make a commitment. We're going to change the pipes, find a way to do it, and lead the charge.
So hard, though, for this governor to do something like that, right? Because everything's got to be planned out and got to make sure that the money's spent correctly. And then you got the same thing with the legislature, right? They just can't allocate $28 million to the city of Flint without having the auditor general involved in this, making sure that the money's spelled out, right? They're so worried about 2 years from now, a report coming out and saying all this money that was squandered in harsh reaction to the Flint water crisis. And meanwhile, they're getting pummeled by the public who are saying, why are we still having these lines through the Red Cross of people just giving out water? How long can this possibly last, you know?
And that's absolutely true. I had a client once that had a gasoline spill in a small community. And the gasoline probably only touched about 10 homes, 10 properties at all. But because of the vapors, they had to shut off the electrical grid. And they shut off 500 homes, and they had to evacuate these 500 homes. So all of a sudden, the spill that only affected 10 houses affected 500 homes. And then it rained that night. And because they shut off the electrical grid, all of their sump pumps stopped working. So they all flooded their basements. And so the next day, he's got a community meeting in a gym, and all these 500 people are there. And they're worried not only about their basements, but an immediate problem, but they're worried about what happens long term. Is this gasoline going to seep into the ground, and is it going to affect our wells? And he stood up and he said, I will hook everybody here up to the water system, the city water system, every house, $5,000 per house. I will hook it up if you want it hooked up. And it basically eliminated the issue because he just got ahead of the issue before anybody else did. I think that's the kind of thing the governor needs to do in this case, is just get ahead of the issue. You know, they don't have to have, you know, and I know he's a detail guy. He likes to have everything planned out, but he doesn't need to have the details now. He just figure out how to do it later on and get the feds in here to help.
One of the things that I've thought about a lot in terms of what we're going to see going forward is, and you've managed a lot of House campaigns, advised a lot of House candidates. Will this story have an impact, Republican prospects, in the state House?
Anytime your leader is effective, and you can see some of the recent polls coming out showing that his handling of this crisis has not exactly been viewed as stellar by the voters. It hasn't necessarily overwhelmingly affect his personal numbers, but we'll see what happens to that. But yeah, I think it certainly could affect candidates down the line because it taints everybody.
All right. Well, speaking about elections, we've got a big one in Iowa tonight, and we're taping on Monday here, obviously, for the MERS Monday podcast. Now, on Friday, our quote of the day was from Steve Mitchell, who said, if Donald Trump wins Iowa, it's all over. Would you concur with that, Tom, or not? If Donald Trump wins Iowa, it's all over.
I don't think so, because I think we haven't played out the other scenario here. I mean, at this point in time, you've got Trump and Cruz sort of fighting for this angry voter and the real conservative part. We haven't heard yet from all of the other seven or eight candidates that are splitting up the traditional Republican vote. So when that field narrows, and then we'll find out whether or not Trump can be challenged. But Trump is starting to gain support from traditional Republican sources now. And he may not be able to be stopped. Even if he doesn't need to win Iowa. Cruz needs to win Iowa. He doesn't win. He's going to win New Hampshire. He's going to win South Carolina. And then he's probably going to go into Super Tuesday and do pretty good. So Trump has got a pretty clear slate so far. What's going to happen is Cruz needs to win here if he needs to somehow stop the Trump train from moving forward. If he doesn't do that, I think he's going to be playing second fiddle, and eventually he's going to be out of the race at some point later on. The other issue is that who's going to be the challenger? I don't think it's necessarily Cruz. Is it going to be, who's that traditional Republican challenger? Is it going to be, at this point, Rubio is looking like the candidate. Kasich's got a possibility because he's doing well in New Hampshire. Christie's probably outside shot at most, but he's still, a lot of people like him. They don't necessarily decide to vote for him, but he could be that person that picks up that mantle and runs with it. So I still think we're going to have to go through that scenario to say who is going to be that traditional Republican candidate out there. And when they get down to a face-off with one-on-one with Trump, who wins? But Trump is, I give him credit, he has become much more popular with traditional Republicans. He's not as radioactive as he was before. Everything he says seems to bounce off. I mean, he's just a Teflon can at this point in time. Every time you think he says something really stupid, it's going to, he seems to gain 3 points in the poll. I think if Cruz doesn't win Iowa, I think Cruz is done. I think he is. I think Trump, but then we haven't seen the rest of the story play out yet.
So it will be Trump versus some establishment candidate at some point.
At some point in time. I think that's where it comes down to.
Now, all right. Now, you didn't mention Bush. Why didn't you mention Bush?
I think Bush is just dead in the water. I think, he may be going to try to get to Super Tuesday. Maybe he's got enough money, but 2 or 3% in Iowa. I mean, this is a place where George W. Bush, won by, double-digit margin when he ran back in 2000.
Is it his personality? Is it the hangover from his brother's presidency? What do you think it is?
I think that's a lot of it. I think it really is. I mean, people are just, have had enough Bush. And his personality is not dynamic by any means. It is laid back. It's not exciting. It's such a contrast to what Trump is. If Trump wasn't in the race, maybe it'd be a little bit different because you'd have a lot of, fairly boring candidates or average candidates he went through. But Trump just changes the dynamic here, and you're compared against that all the time. And I think that's just, they've had enough, and they're just looking for somebody else. And he's just not the guy. I mean, he's, even in New Hampshire, I mean, he's running in single digits. If he can't do there, he's not going to do, maybe in South Carolina, he breaks single digits, but that's it. But I think the campaign's done.
Now, Tom, you brought a bunch of polling in with you. What's the most striking thing that you're seeing here?
I think what's most striking, I'm going through this, is the polling that was done by Target Point, and that where they asked whether or not people would consider certain candidates or they wouldn't consider certain candidates, just to know what's the possibility among Republican voters. And Donald Trump overwhelmingly, 77% of the Republicans would consider voting for him, and including 40% strongly consider voting for him. Then you go down, you know, Cruz, Rubio, and then Carson. But everybody sort of likes Carson, but no one's voting for him anymore. I mean, he's dropping like a... And then it's Christie, and those are probably it. I mean, the interesting part here is only 33% of the Republicans would consider voting for Jeb Bush.
Would even consider it?
Even consider voting for Jeb Bush. It's not like he's not known. I mean, Kasich has low numbers, but he's not known as well among Republican voters. If he got a boost, I think maybe he would. It would be a little bit different if he did something in New Hampshire better than what he was expected to do. If he comes in second to Trump in New Hampshire, I think that'll give him a little bit of boost. But he's not going to win South Carolina. He's not going to do well on Super Tuesday, which is all those southern states. And so, you know, he could find himself again, you know, 3 weeks later being, you know, the low man in totem pole, coming into Michigan and some of the Midwestern states. And maybe try to pick it up a little bit.
All right, Tom, let's go ahead and touch on the Democratic field right now. What do you see happening here?
You know, Sanders is, you know, he's put together a campaign of $5 contributions and a lot of shoe leather, and he's got a lot of young supporters out there. Sort of reminds you of the Obama campaign back 8 years ago. And I think, you know, there's a possibility without a snowstorm is Sanders wins tonight. And then he's certainly going to win New Hampshire. And then if he does that, then he's probably dead in the water because he's not going to do anything in any of those southern states, especially South Carolina. You know, he has to, you know, save enough money and get back to the Midwest to give it a shot. But it's going to upset the apple cart, I think, in the Democratic primary for a while. But I think Hillary's probably still the candidate unless she gets indicted.
Unless she gets indicted. You threw that little curveball in there.
I don't know. So some people think that that's a possibility. But there is, you know, as a candidate, she's damaged at this point in time for a lot of different reasons. And it's probably what gives Trump a lot more potential, I think, in a campaign. If she was a sterling candidate and without all the baggage necessarily, I think he'd have a tough time winning. But I think it opens the door for him and a lot of other people.
And if we have a Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump race, then Bloomberg might get in at that point, right?
That would be a great debate, though, wouldn't it? I want to see that debate.
Oh, that would be a fantastic
Bernie Sanders,
debate.
Donald Trump, that'd be great.
Oh, it would be wonderful. I mean, Sanders is not fazed at all by Trump.
No,
and Trump. I think it would just frustrate Trump.
Oh, I think it could be very amusing.
Wait, but what do you think about Bloomberg? Bloomberg then gets in if those two are the nominees.
You know, I don't know where. If Bloomberg gets in a race, I don't know where he draws votes from.
The middle. Because you got Sanders on the left, you got Trump on the right, and then he can go right in the middle.
Right, but I don't necessarily think he pulls votes more from Republicans or Democrats.
Right.
I mean, he's probably the most liberal Republican that we've ever seen, you know, elected to office, at least, you know, nationwide. He's got some nationwide pull. But yeah, I don't necessarily. I think you're right. He pulls from the middle, people who can't stomach a socialist, and near him, you know, can't stomach Trump.
All the non-soda drinkers.
There you go.
Joining me on the other end of the line are a couple of congressmen from the state of Michigan, Bill Huizenga and John Molinar. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Thank you, Kyle. Good to be with you today.
Yeah, we're happy to be with you. So tell me where you are right now in the great state of Iowa.
Today we're going to be in a very northern part of northwestern Iowa, real close to the border of Minnesota and up by South Dakota. So we're starting with a breakfast up there, and then we're going to be meeting with a group of people in Sioux Center at 1 o'clock, a group of community leaders and ministers and some folks there, and then we're going to be splitting up. This is Bill. I'm going to be going to a caucus in Lamar's and going to be in a different place.
And I'll be in Ida Grove.
Now you guys are getting pretty deep into the Iowa lexicon here. I don't know where any of these places are, but they're all very – every place is significant when you're talking about the Iowa caucuses, though, isn't it?
It is, and where they're actually sending us is they call those super caucus sites, and what that means is it's the whole county – gathers in one area, so it's going to be a little bigger than just you know, like the city of Orange City or Sioux Center or some of these other smaller towns that might split up. They're taking the whole county and putting it in one place, so there'll be literally hundreds of people at each of these caucus sites.
There are 99 counties in Iowa, so if you think of Michigan, we have 83 counties. That's a lot of geography. 99 counties, that's pretty rural, and each of these counties has at least one, often several locations to caucus.
Have you guys ever been a part of this caucus atmosphere before, either of you?
The closest thing for me, this is Bill, the closest thing for me was 4 years ago. I was up in New Hampshire and spent about 3 or 4 days up there and endorsed Mitt Romney while I was up there and helped out and just hit phone banks and that kind of stuff. And So we were doing sort of the same thing here over the weekend, but for my first time in Iowa, I think for John too.
Yeah, this is my first time participating in the Iowa caucuses. It's been fascinating. We've been meeting with students, leaders in agriculture, people throughout every walk of life in Iowa, and getting to know them and getting their perspective and just telling them why we're for Marco Rubio.
So what kind of reception have you guys been receiving so far? Do you get the sense that folks have made their mind up, or is there still some who have an open mind on what they're going to be doing?
You know, the Iowa voters take this very seriously. We had rallies for Marco Rubio in the last few days, and in each of those rallies, there were people who had attended multiple rallies. Some had attended debates. They were still working through the process of who they were going to support at the caucuses. They know they're going to caucus, but they're doing their research, their due diligence, and taking their first in the nation status very seriously. Fortunately, I believe Marco has a lot of momentum leading into this caucus night, and I'm very encouraged to see people turning their support his way.
I saw a statistic, I think it was out of the Sioux City Gazette, that they estimate that around half of the people going to caucus haven't made up their mind until the last 48 hours. Wow. And they really are trying to do their, as John said, their due diligence. They take it very seriously, and they want to make a good choice because they know that this is really sort of a launching point in many ways for people to see what these candidates are made of. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what kind of momentum that Rubio is going to sustain. I really definitely feel it in the conversations that I've had. It seems that Cruz has really kind of shot himself in the foot with a few missteps here over the last few days. And you know, everybody pretty much anticipates that it's going to be a Trump win with a Cruz and Rubio close second and third. And but we'll see what kind of who really is going to get that momentum coming out of Iowa into New Hampshire and into South Carolina.
Well, that was going to be my next question here. What would be a success for the Rubio campaign coming out of Iowa?
I think finishing in the top three really adds credibility and strength to his campaign. I think he's someone who was not well known in Iowa, but has really developed support here. He's been running strong in each of the early states, and Iowa has really embraced him in the last few weeks. And so we're excited that we believe he'll finish in the top three.
Yeah, and I think for Cruz, frankly, he's been the one setting expectations about beating Trump here. And Des Moines Register just had their latest poll that came out Saturday was showing Trump now beating Cruz. So the interesting thing is that Cruz has set himself up to win, you know, with the ground game that he's had, but he seems to be stumbling on that. Rubio's had much less of an organization, not that saying he doesn't have an organization, but I mean, Cruz is really focused and concentrated on this. And for him to do, frankly, better than most people expected, for Cruz to do less well than what even he put out there that he would do, I think we'll probably see a bigger win for Rubio than we'll see for either Trump or Cruz coming out of this.
On Friday, we talked with Steve Mitchell from Mitchell Research and Communications. He did a poll in Michigan. And in talking with me, he said that if Trump wins Iowa, it's all over. What's wrong with that theory?
Well, I think that really negates the role that the voters play. It negates every day there are new stories that come out, new information for voters. You know, just being out here these last several days, you've seen different themes emerge in each of the campaigns. And so I don't think you can ever make a prediction like that. I think if Trump wins in Iowa, that certainly gives him credibility as, you know, winning the first state, but he's got to continue that and he will face more scrutiny. And I think when we've seen Trump face additional scrutiny, sometimes he's left the stage.
Yeah, literally. And Kyle, let me give you one date, March 1, Super Tuesday. I mean, I don't know how anybody can discount what that may do to the field. So you've got these guys going in, playing hard in New Hampshire. Kasich's been basically living in New Hampshire. You've got South Carolina out to Nevada, and then you're going to be having Super Tuesday. And that is, I think, definitely going to shape the direction of where we're going. So I don't know how we could possibly declare anybody a winner that early on before we've even gotten to Super Tuesday, much less you know, the role that Michigan's going to play on March 8th.
All right, very good. Last question I had for you guys. As you're going around, and obviously you're introduced as, or you introduced yourself as a congressman from Michigan, how do people in Iowa react to something like that? I mean, they're used to meeting candidates face-to-face. They're used to seeing a lot of politicians roaming around their state, you know, for at least the last year, if not two. What kind of reaction do they give you guys?
Well, Bill and I have had kind of a unique approach here. Bill is a graduate of Calvin College. I'm a graduate of Hope College, both of Dutch heritage. And so we've gone into different communities where they know about the rivalry between Hope and Calvin. And so we've talked about this being the Dutch Unity Tour and Marco Rubio being the candidate that can bring our party together as well as our country together. And they find that interesting. And there's a lot of crossover between families and relatives between Michigan and Iowa. So that's been a lot of fun for us.
Yeah, and actually my my hometown minister in Zealand, his last church that he pastored was in Pella, Iowa. Our youth minister is from northwest Iowa, and I saw some of his family members at church on Sunday and out here in Iowa. So, you know, there's a lot of connections, and for as I was talking to people, they'd say, oh, yeah, we've heard about you guys from, you know, they kind of follow this little Dutch enclave, both in Michigan and out here in Iowa and other places around. They've sort of heard of us. We all have friends that are from here and relations, you know, cousins and that kind of thing. So it's been a very, very warm welcome. They've been very interested in getting our take on it as much as we've been asking them, you know, kind of like what's going on. And they've been asking both John and I, well, what's your take? You work with, you know, Cruz and Rubio in Washington, and you've kind of see how it works from the inside. What about, you know, some of the other candidates? So they've been very open and receptive as we've been asking them to join us in supporting Rubio.
So when you brought up that Cruz, is he really as prickly in person as everyone says he is?
maybe the uncomfortable chuckle answers your question, but yes.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, it sounds like that's the furthest you guys want to go on that. And so with that, we'll wrap it up. Bill Huizenga and John Mullen are the two of our congressmen from the state of Michigan. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Hey, thank you, Kyle.
Yeah, thanks, Kyle.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS. Thanks to Tom Shields for coming in this morning, and also to Bill Huizenga and John Mullen, our U.S. congressman, and Matt Stewart for hooking that up. And big news Lauren shared this morning. Michael Gerstein has a Twitter account. This is big news. Michael Gerstein, former intern at MERS, is going to be starting at the AP tomorrow, and he's going to have a Twitter account. Are we going to start following him now?
I'm already following him.
Are you really?
Yeah, big fan.
God,
so.
You are all on it,
yeah.
Jacob.
Well, he followed me. I figured I should give him a follow back, and looking forward to seeing him work in the Capitol still at the AP.
You've already followed him, right, Lauren?
No, actually, I have not followed him yet, but I do plan to.
It is. This is such a change to see Gerstein actually have
a Twitter account.
Yeah.
Yes.
The question will be, how long will it take him to surpass the number of tweets that I have done, which is, I think, about 100 or something.
Oh, I'm not sure. It depends on how much they have him use it. But yeah,
that's
good.
That is the big question.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you have definitely taken the largely anti-Twitter stance.
Well, I don't know if I would say anti-Twitter, just passive, cautious.
Passive.
The answer to that question, Kyle, depends on how much of a filter he puts on his philosophical thoughts. You know, obviously he'll be reporting on things, but maybe he'll take a step further and share what's on his mind with the rest of the Twitter sphere.
If that's the case, it'll be a couple days.
That's what I'm hoping for anyway. We miss Michael's philosophical thoughts from time to time. And so now that he's on Twitter, I'll feel like he never left.
Michael, if you're listening, we'll just give you a hard time and good luck, man.
Good luck, Michael. We're going to be looking forward to seeing you around the Capitol working for the AP. All right, until next week, I'm Kyle Mullen. Take care.